Brigadier Calvert, Reel 20.
Well, I went over to see Second Army about the employment of the French and of the Second SAS, and I didn't see Commander of the Second Army or Montgomery, but I did see that Chiefs of Staff, Freddy de Gangor, and his Chief of Staff. And they were just about to do the crossing of the Weser, at the Rhine, at Weser. And I suggested that they could either be dropped or infiltrated ahead and to fan out ahead of the 6th Airborne, who were dropping across the Rhine. They thought it was a good idea, but I was eventually turned down because they said it was too late. They'd got all their march orders and everything else already committed, and they couldn't add another single unit to the to their orders. So I was made temporarily a liaison officer with General Gale, and under he was deputy commander of 1st Allied Airborne Army. Now, I get muddled up as to who the American was. It was may have been General Ridgway, or it may have been none of the other commanders in Korea or something like that. I think it was Ridgway. Anyway, one of the assets of being a commander of the SAS is I had a light aircraft of my own flown by an RAF officer, and so I said I'd fly over the Rhine and try and land after the 6th Airborne had landed, and then fly back again and report. I was encouraged to do this by General Gale. I'd brought my signals officer with me as acting brigade major. After watching the airborne landing, we flew over and we landed in a field, and unfortunately the pilot wasn't a very good one, otherwise he wouldn't have been given the job, and we turned on our nose and bent the propeller, but quite unaffected otherwise. I wandered around and got everybody's views, and then decided to walk back. This was a very, very heavily imbued in my mind. It was a great moment, really. I wasn't used to European warfare, and I wanted to see what difference there was. And I was a bit windy about the only things which I felt I wasn't quite able to compete with were mines and minefields, because we didn't have those in Burma. So I walked rather delicately back, and the first people I met were the forward platoon of a battalion or a brigade. I don't remember what regiment it was. Now, 6th Airborne had been a bit apprehensive of being left on their own too long, like the 1st Airborne had been at Arnhem. And they wanted the 2nd Army to contact them very quickly. I came across this platoon and it stopped. I said, "Why have you stopped?" And they said, "Well, two of our Bren carriers got blown up on mines." I said, "But there's no Germans between you." And they said, "Yes, I just walked through there." And they said, "Well, our orders are to stop." So I went on to the battalion. The same thing, same answer was, "Oh, yes, very interesting seeing you." I said, "Aren't you going to get on with the job?" And he said, "Well, we've had heavy casualties." I said, "What other casualties?" "We had two Bren carriers blown up." And I eventually got to the Rhine, and I crossed it. And the brigade had got three battalions across the Rhine, yet the brigadier and his headquarters were still on the western side of the Rhine and was just sitting there. I was appalled because certainly in Burma by now, brigadiers knew that their answer was possibly to lead their brigades and get a move on. But it did show me that in Europe things were done on a very, very much stereotyped style, and there didn't appear to be any great hurry, certainly not Second Army. And I got a jeep and saw General Gale, and I think it was General Ridgway. I don't know whether it was, anyway, the Allied Airborne Commander, very tall, imposing chap. And I reported that there were no Germans between the airborne forces and the Second Army, but the Second Army were going very slowly, and I described the situation. I remember that because it was a different type of war, what we were used to in Burma, because I may say after General Wingate's leadership and exploits, other commanders like brigadiers and divisional commanders did emulate him, and people like General Rees and others, in their dash to the Irrawaddy, and others when they went down south to Rangoon, divisional headquarters was usually not exactly leading the way, but was always very much in the forefront. And it was surprising to see what I thought was rather a lethargic attitude of the British Army. I think it had probably had very heavy casualties in Normandy, and people were slow in getting on with it. Now, one of the staff officers I'd met at Second Army was a chap, and I can look up his name, who became Speaker of the House of Commons and later was made a Lord, that is, a Conservative, and he had a double-barrel name. Now, I met him years later, and he said, you know, I always felt very apologetic to you about the way we didn't employ your men, which we could have done, we'd have liked to have done, so we talked about it afterwards. And we did need them, because due to casualties, and because it was near the end of the war, the British Army, the British soldiers, weren't all that keen on advancing. And he said, I lost five of some of my best friends who, as company commanders, had to lead their men ahead in order to get them on. There was this lethargy, which the Americans complained about, of the British Army. And it may have been due to training, it may have been due to restrictions like bomb lines, or it may have been due to just the whole heavy weight of bureaucracy. Or it may have been the choice of people who went into the infantry and who possibly wouldn't advance unless there was some armour in front of them. And there was a tendency, which is not my criticism but others, that the army wouldn't advance unless there'd been enormous shelling and bombing beforehand. And the RAF used to say, we've sucked along the British Army. We made a vacuum and they were sucked into it. And this shelling and so on was just so-called prophylactic. It landed anywhere. They didn't find out whether any Germans there. But it did, of course, destroy the countryside. So I went up. I was told by de Gangon to go and see the Canadians, and he sent them a signal saying I was coming along. I went to see the Canadians. Now, they were the the Rhine had been crossed, but the river Ischl, I-J-S, Ischl, I-J-S-E-S-S-E-L, something like that. It was one of the big streams of the Rhine.
One of the
Delta.
Distributors.
Yes. Well, distributors, not tributaries. Yes. And it had not been crossed. The Germans were in a bit of a bottleneck in the Amsterdam-Rotterdam area, but there still was a line of communication across the road, the viaduct crossing the entrance to the Zuider Zee. Now the Dutch were apprehensive that put it this way, the Canadians' next objective was Emden, and they would have to cross eastern Holland to get there. Now the Dutch were apprehensive that if the Allied forces carried out their usual tactics at that time and put enormous bombardments and bombing in that area, it would destroy all the irrigation of the whole area. And I was asked whether I could suggest something else. And so I suggested that use the two French battalions who were terribly keen to get into action and to attack. I will say this to the French. People say, like I attended this morale in battle seminar at the Staff College, that people don't fight for high ideals. It's all very small. Well, certainly these French wanted to prove how good the French army was and to what I call recover the soul of France. They really were keen, they really were enthusiasts and dedicated. Although they might behave a bit badly in Britain, but that didn't make them any less good soldiers. And so I suggested that we should drop them as a sort of carpet for the advance of the Canadian Army. I will give you an article which I've written which will illustrate this. It's written for fairly junior people, so it's not high grade writing. And in this we would blow bridges either side of this pathway, but defend the bridges en route so that it would make a pathway across this very marshy canal ground east of the Zuider Zee and from the River Ischl onwards. So, having decided on that, I of course wanted a quick follow-up by the Canadians, and they promised me that they would overrun these men within 48 hours. So I made it 72 hours. I also went and saw the Canadian Air Force, and we were supported by, I think, there were typhoons, I think it was, or was it tornadoes, whatever. And I said, now, I've been used to very close air support in Burma. Can you do the same sort of thing? And can we talk to you in the air? And they arranged all that. Then I went back to Essex, and I want to emphasize that from the time of when I discussed this with General Simmons, who was the commander of the 2nd Canadian Division, and his chief staff officer, Homer Mann. I think Homer is a his real name was M-A-N-N, and I think Homer's is what's his name?
Christian name.
Not Christian.
Middle name. Nickname.
Nickname. Yes. And I also saw the Army Commander General Crerar. And everything, if I was going to say, from the time I saw them to the time we actually operated was 6 days. Now, one of the failures of the Allied Airborne Army in use of airborne forces was the enormous time it took from the time the decision was made to drop them to the time they were dropped, by which time the whole aspect of the battle and the strategy very often changed. I think that Allied Airborne Army from Normandy onwards made plans for about 20 or 30 different parachute operations, of which only two came off. That was Arnhem and the Rhine crossing. Forces on the ground didn't really like parachute drops because it forced their hand. They had to get there. General Slim didn't like parachute people because they felt that they were being forced to do something which circumstances might prevent them from getting there in time. I had discussed all this. I went back to Essex and I told Prendergast, that Prendergast is the liaison officer, my second in command, what we were going to do, and I gave him all the things, and we made plans with the French. Now, the French were very, very keen on having their armored jeeps with them. And so we arranged that after they had been dropped, there'd be a second drop of armored jeeps. In order to do this pathway type of drop, we decided to drop from 1,500 feet. It would happen to be through clouds in 40 different dropping zones, accompanied with battle simulators, to make out that we were a much stronger force than we were. I, of course, was in close touch with, I think it was 38 Group, and their Sasso, and they, of course, joined in all the discussions on our drop. They had been very, very good dropping to the SAS in France, and we had a very close liaison with them. We had a liaison officer living with us, headquarters. I then went back to Holland. I also wanted to, I had this Belgian unit, and I wanted to use them, have them under my thumb, so that if the Canadians were slow, I could try and go ahead and overrun the French myself. So they were shipped over to Holland with some of the British SAS. And then I flew back to Essex to see the French the night before the drop. And I gave them a talk. And this was in French, so-called French. And I described the type of country which they were going to drop in, which I had looked up in the sort of topographical notes of that area. And I finished up by saying that in that area, a lot of the country is moorland, in which there's a large number of pheasants, hares, and rabbits. And there was a pause, and then they shouted with laughter, because this is what they've been had up for shooting in England. And it is of interest, I might say it now, that when I did motor up to them, I overran quite a lot of the French for the first time. So the first person they saw was a British brigadier in a red hat. They haven't forgotten that to this day. But I remember one young Frenchman came out and greeted me, "Ah, mon général," because he'd been fighting for about a week and longing for us to help him. And then he rushed back, said, "Attendez, attendez, mon général," and he rushed back to their hideout, and he brought me two pheasants and presented them to me. Well, then I was went to my own headquarters and awaited the drop, which occurred all right. Then we got a lot of messages. Our signals organization was very good, and I got messages from here, there, and everywhere. They had trouble. A lot of the drops were in the wrong place. The RAF said that they're dropping on G, across of a G, from two different directions, and it was a very narrow crossing, so there could be quite a lot of, they might drop up to 2 to 6 miles off course. I didn't mind this very much because the main thing was to confuse the Germans, which it did utterly. And the battle simulators went off, bang, 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 boom, boom, so on like that. Some of the French who were used to secrecy in Normandy, they get rather put out by these noises. But the main thing was the Germans were even more put out. We dropped right across. I ought to give some names. I was going to say I must get in some name, some geography. The drops were beyond the river Ischl, and the southernmost towns were Zwolle, Zwolle, and Coevorden, Coevorden, Meppel, and then on to Assen, which is in the centre of the area, and on to Groningen, Groningen. And Groningen, the capture of Groningen cut off the main road to the German troops in the Amsterdam, Rotterdam area, east, west of the Zuider Zee. And another lot went towards Leeuwarden, Leeuwarden, which is on the same road. It was all crisscrossed by canals, and the object was, as I say, to put a carpet down for the Canadian Army, First Canadian Army, to get there. The French forces were under, mainly under Colonel Boulardier, and one other name, which I can tell you later on, Colonel Bourgoin, Lieutenant Colonel Bourgoin, Bourgoin. Well, I sat at my headquarters somewhere near Coevorden, very anxious that something should occur. But the Canadian Army was held up at its crossing. I got the signal to say that they had low priority. And the high priority had already, for bridging, had gone to the Second British Army. I don't know whether this is true or could be true, but my humble opinion is, and I have nothing very much to support it, that the Canadian Army were that the Allied Army, especially the British and Canadian, were a bit lumbering, cumbersome. I think they'd all collected transport as they crossed Europe, and possibly they didn't understand the principle of the optimum. Up to a certain point, the more transport you have, the more mobile you are. After a certain point, which is the optimum, the more transport you have, you get less and less mobile. And I think they'd got far too many, much transport which they didn't need and which they carried along with them just in case. Or it may have been as trophies of war. But they were very slow crossing, and they didn't seem to have that urgency. They were supposed to be, and time went on. So after frantic messages from the French, including one Frenchman said, "Can I have a lot of barbed wire to make a prisoner of war camp? I've got so many prisoners." I set forth with, I launched the French, I launched the Belgian battalion, and I also did manage to get hold of a Polish SP battery. I also got hold of, I can't remember how it occurred, a large Daimler car with a Union Jack painted across it, and I went forward myself in my red hat with a staff officer, Major Potter Miller Mundy, MILLER MUNDY, hyphenated, and one armored jeep. And we went along as if the war was over. And as we came through, all the Dutch came out and pointed to us and cheered, and Germans surrendered. I ought to mention the fact that it was debated quite very seriously as to whether we should inform the Dutch resistance in this area that this operation was going to take place. And we decided, and I think I was the determining factor in the decision, that we would not do so, as the Dutch had been penetrated by the Germans. The SOE had been penetrated by the Germans. And I confirm this later at reunions. I've met a lot of the ex-SOE forces, the Dutch resistance, and I've asked them, I said, should I have let you know or not? And in all cases, the actual Dutchman who took part, who lived in that area, said no. He said that it would be far too risky, than word would have got to the Germans straight away. And so this is what may be one of the reasons why Arnhem failed. The Dutch were in that area, very close to Germany, were very closely linked up to the Germans. I have been criticized for that later on. All these people said, oh, if only the Dutch resistance had been told, things would have been very much easier. But I think there would have been catastrophe. Now, we went forward, and we...